Welcome to KDNK's Weekly Newsreel,
a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. The weekly newsreel is underwritten by RJ Paddywhack's Pet Outfitters, next to City Market in Elgeville, open 7 days a week. More info at 970-963-1700 or rjpaddywhacks.com.
I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. Here are a few headlines from the week, including an update on the sinkhole that revealed itself under Highway 133 on Wednesday.
A 15-by-12-foot sinkhole on Highway 133 south of the Main Street intersection in Carbondale has been repaired. In a press release issued Thursday afternoon, the Colorado Department of Transportation reports that crews used 125 tons of road base to fill the hole, which opened up Wednesday when a CDOT employee tried to fill a pothole. What looked like a small depression began breaking open and revealed a 12-foot drop into a cavernous dark hole. CDOT will continue to monitor the sinkhole. The cause has not yet been determined.
The Aspen Ideas Fest has a new idea this summer. It's going online from June 28th to July 2nd and will be free for the first time in its 16-year history. Speakers include Stacey Abrams, former House Minority Leader of the Georgia House of Representatives, musician David Byrne, former U.S. Secretary of State Dr. Madeleine Albright, Dr. Anthony Fauci, and more. Information on programs and speakers is at aspenideas.org. The Olay the Sweet Corn Festival is canceled for this year. The 29th annual fest was scheduled for August 1st. The Montrose Daily Press reports that those who purchase tickets will get refunds.
Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports the state of Oregon has joined landowners, environmentalists, and others in petitioning for judicial rule review of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's decisions in favor of the Jordan Cove Liquefied Natural Gas Project. The Jordan Cove Project received approval from the FERC, but has been unable to get approval from any state agency. Now state agencies are challenging the FERC approval, saying it violates and allows violations of federal environmental laws.
Aspen's Meat and Cheese restaurant announced a temporary closure Friday after an employee tested positive for COVID-19. The Aspen Times reports the employee received testing on Thursday after self-reporting symptoms of aches, pains, and sore throat. Heather Savory Pies and Tapas Bar in Basalt also announced a temporary closure last week after co-owner Heather Lujan tested positive for the virus. Meat and Cheese restaurant is expecting to remain closed for around 2 weeks. Heather's currently plans to reopen on June 22nd, the day after Father's Day. Vandals literally turned over the patio at Carbondale Beer Works Tuesday. Owner Patrice Fuller told KDNK that when she arrived at work, everything was flipped upside down. She said the fire pit and all the potted plants were turned over, scattering rocks and dirt, and the picnic tables were stacked on top of each other. She added that, luckily, there was no propane in the fire pit. Garfield County commissioners Monday banned the use of all fireworks in unincorporated parts of the county for the rest of 2020, including the July 4th weekend. This restriction applies to all private citizens and all county lands outside municipal boundaries. Commercial vendors planning a fireworks display anywhere in unincorporated Garfield County must receive approval from local fire districts. The ban does not prohibit sales of fireworks. Rennell Lott, County Communications Officer, told KDNK in an email that, quote, people can purchase them but not set them off in Garfield County, end quote.
In a normal year, this weekend would have drawn crowds from near and far for the oldest continuously held civic celebration west of the Mississippi. KDNK's Raleigh Burley has this report on Strawberry Days 2020.
A weekend of music, artisan vendors, and games. The crowning tradition of Strawberry Days is the serving of ice cream and cake topped with strawberries. This, among many other facets, has been logistically challenged by the ongoing novel coronavirus pandemic. Strawberry Days began in 1898 to showcase fruit grown in the Roaring Fork and Grand River valleys. The festival has subsequently featured entertainers like the Human Fly, scaling the Hotel Colorado in 1917, and actor Tom Mix, who was a guest of honor during filming for The Great K&A Train Robbery in 1926. It was announced on April 10th, 2020, by the Glenwood Springs Chamber Resort Association that this year's festival would be skipped over to prioritize the health and safety of the community. An article in the Post-Independent elaborates that key decisions regarding vendors, contracts, and sponsorship are made months in advance. To delay those decisions beyond April with the uncertainty of a global pandemic was deemed impractical. In the festival's 123 years, this marks the sixth cancellation, according to the Frontier Historical Society. Notably, the Spanish influenza epidemic swept through the area in late 1918 through early 1919, apparently leaving the summer celebration unaffected. Five consecutive years were foregone from 1942 through 1946, due first to a reported shortage of cake, ice cream, and good entertainment, and then World War II. The festival was revived in 1947, accumulating new traditions like the Strawberry Shortcut, a 5K and 10K race beginning in 1978. The shortcut now includes a one-mile fun run and benefits Special Olympics Colorado.
What's your favorite thing about the Strawberry Shortcut, buddy, running the shortcut?
My grandparents see him 10 years ago.
Yeah, because he likes going because his grandparents get to watch him run.
Special Olympian Josh Chavez, whose family is one of the race's biggest sponsors, looks to the horizon for future opportunities to resume these cherished traditions.
We're hoping that they do something, whether it's a virtual race in the fall or whether they can have something later in the year.
Yeah.
Because we definitely want to be part of it.
The Glenwood Springs Chamber Resort Association also expressed hopes to plan some kind of community gathering later this summer or fall. For KDNK News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
June's primary election moves forward with COVID-19 restrictions. Here's more from my recent socially distanced conversation with Garfield County Clerk and Recorder Jean Albarico at Carbondale's Town Hall.
Are we going to have them come into the lobby and then into the council meeting room first and then route the traffic around and out this room we're in here?
Which Garfield County Clerk Jean Albarico and her staff are preparing for Colorado's primary election at the end of June. Colorado uses all-mail ballots. In-person voting is still an option on Election Day, but the COVID-19 pandemic has changed how that will happen. First, said Albarico, the number of voting centers in the county has basically been cut in half.
The Secretary of State basically put it in the temporary rule that we were only to open the minimum amount of vote centers that were required, and that's determined by the number of registered voters you have in your county. Mm-hmm. So Garfield County is required to have two early voting sites. And then on Election Day, we need one additional vote center. So my minimum requirement is three.
That's down from the usual seven.
The Secretary of State also asked county clerks not use their main office for a vote center. And I've always used my office in Glenwood as our early voting center. And so with this election being the last Tuesday of June, and there be no conflicting board meetings and stuff, we will be doing the early voting in Glenwood at the county administration building in the room where the county commissioners meet instead of in my office in the courthouse.
So let's get that straight. Early voting starts on June 22nd, and there are two early voting centers.
One will be at the county administration building in Glenwood, which is 108 8th Street, room 100, where the commissioners meet. And they'll be there 8:30 to 5, Monday through Friday. On Saturday, June 27th, from 10 to 2, and then the next Monday, June 29th, from 8:30 to 5, and then Election Day from 7 to 7.
The other early voting center is at the County Administration Building in Rifle at 195 West 14th Street and has the same hours as the one in Glenwood. The voting center at Carbondale Town Hall will only be open on Election Day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Albarico warns that with social distancing requirements, there may be lines at the voting centers on Election Day. She recommends that people vote early or put ballots in the mail by June 24th so they'll get to the courthouse by June 30th. And if those options don't work, voters can use one of the 24/7 drop boxes at Carbondale Town Hall on 8th Street in Glenwood in front of the courthouse or at the County Administration Building in Rifle.
And I just found out that the Secretary of State is going to use some of the money that was released through the CARES Act to help with election processes, is going to allow each county to apply for a grant to install one additional 24/7 drop box. And I have already started making arrangements to do that down in Parrish.
Albarico says for the primary election, unaffiliated voters have been sent more than one ballot, but they can only vote one. If they vote more than one ballot, none of the ballots will be counted. She adds that more people seem to be casting votes on multiple primary ballots, which means that the amount of wasted votes is on the rise.
The first time we did the unaffiliated voters was the primary in June of 2018. We had 166 ballots that could not be counted because the voters sent both ballots back voted. For this presidential primary in March, we had 291.
You can find all the election details, times, locations, and dates at the Garfield County website.
You're listening to the Weekly News Reel, featuring top stories aired between Monday and Friday. In-kind support comes from Grassroots Community Network, promoting civic participation through civil discourse, creative endeavors, and cultural interaction. Grassroots TV also partners with KD&K to air live Pitkin County public health and community meetings. More info at grassrootstv.org.
Protests around the country are highlighting the deep history of police violence and systemic racism in the U.S. Mountain West News Bureau is elevating the voices of people directly affected by that racism. Nate Hedgie presents opinions of three indigenous men about the protests and America's legacy of oppression.
My name is Robert Upham. I was raised on the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation, home of the Gros Ventre and the Assiniboine. I'm also the relative of the Dakota 38. The Dakota 38 were hung, the largest mass execution in United States history. They were hung by decision by Abraham Lincoln in 1862. They were hung a day after Christmas because of an uprising, because they wouldn't abide by their treaty rights and feed us our rations, which were accorded to us. We were starving to death. So the same guy that freed the slaves is the guy that hung us.
Kenneth Tuffy Helgeson. Wam neo no jemajia chen wasewak bagichi daha namakota. I'm an Assiniboine from Fort Belknap, Montana. There was an educator years ago who came and was doing some interviews with some old fellas, and he was asking them, you know, how it was on the reservation during the Great Depression. And the old fella's answer was, we didn't even know it was going on. It's always hard here.
Some people think I'm co-opting a black movement. They don't know how much we're related. We're related because we're equally oppressed. And they keep saying on the news, the original sin is slavery. I'm sorry, but I'm an Indian man. I'm still alive. I'm the evidence of who once had title to this land. And the original sin is the theft of our land.
This is occupied territory. My American name is Alan Ray Matt. But my real name is Kumsta. C-O-O-M-S-T-A. You know, when they wanted us to go to war, we're the first ones to sign up. While we were saying pledge allegiance to the flag and going to war, they were busy taking our land and water here. Where my heart is on the ground today is because I returned over 50 years ago, and it hasn't changed. The cops are worse today. The cops are brutal. They're afraid of peace. You know, their world didn't work. It failed. So now, you know, they're in the minority now, and they fear that. I guess that's all I could say is fear, 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 because what we're listening to is the hearts of our people screaming out in any way they can for peace. That's the right thing. You know, that's all we can do, maybe. Us old guys, we pray.
Tune in next week during KDNK's local and regional news for a report from the Juneteenth Black Lives Matter protest in Rifle. The governor's statewide moratorium on evictions expired on Saturday, June 13th. To mitigate potential conflict between landlords and tenants, Alpine Legal Services set up a mediation hotline. Executive Director Jennifer Wary shares details about the program with KDNK's Raleigh Burley.
Welcome, Jennifer. What can you tell us about the end of eviction moratoriums locally?
Governor Polis's executive order that prevents evictions from being filed statewide, that's going to be expiring on June 13th. So starting Monday, evictions can be filed locally.
And so what does Alpine Legal Services anticipate, and what are you doing as an organization to sort of get ahead of it?
Well, we've been hearing some wonderful stories about landlords who have been depleting their own savings to work with tenants and to keep people in their homes. We've also been hearing some pretty tragic stories about tenants who are being threatened by their landlords and are living in fear of homelessness. So we're hearing really the full spectrum of goodwill and lack of goodwill. So we don't know what to expect. We're hoping that we don't see a flood of evictions on Monday, but we have to prepare for the worst case scenario. Prevention of evictions looks like injecting conflict resolution into our community right now. We have so many good-hearted human beings living in our community, from Parachute to Aspen, but even the best people in the world can sometimes have a lack of compassion or lack of willingness to communicate with others right now. So we have a mediation hotline that will connect you to a volunteer who will assess the situation and pair a tenant or a landlord with a professional trained mediator who can help facilitate communication and hopefully work out a plan to avoid an eviction. And if there is an eviction already pending, to work out a plan that can be submitted to the court to resolve the eviction case. Our hotline number is 970-230-3935. Again, that's 230-3935. If the mediator is not bilingual, we will have translators provided as well for free.
Is the mediation hotline also a service that's being provided at no cost?
All of our services are free, and the mediation hotline is also being provided for free thanks to receiving funds from the Aspen Community Foundation Rescue Fund. If we see representation as necessary to uphold attendance rights, our goal is for 100% of tenants who cannot afford an attorney to have one going into an eviction hearing.
This came to my attention based on a call for volunteers. So could you talk a little bit about how people can be involved acting as a volunteer with this program?
Anyone who's interested in volunteering for the hotline to connect parties, to connect landlords and tenants to mediators, can call the hotline 230-3935 or email our AmeriCorps VISTA volunteer, who is incredible. His name's Caleb, C-A-L-E-B, at alpinelegalservices.org. All that's required is a smartphone to download the app to receive calls through the queue.
Well, thank you so much, Jennifer Wary, for your work with Alpine Legal Services and for providing this service in a time of need.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for letting us tell the community about it. We really appreciate it. We appreciate everything KDNK is doing as well.
The Alpine Legal Services hotline is 970-230-3935. Ding! The Glenwood Springs City Council Thursday rejected an application for a marijuana dispensary, and some think it's time for the city to determine whether or not to limit pot shops.
Every one of these marijuana hearings is valid, and we appreciate all the comment, but there's always a few in opposition that say, you know, how many pot stores is enough?
John Diet, owner of The Kind Castle, spoke to the Glenwood Springs City Council Thursday night about his application for a special use permit to open a marijuana dispensary in South Glenwood. He told council, after most of the discussion and public comment, that this hearing is not about whether there are too many dispensaries in town.
I'm following the current code the way it is. You know, people can come in and say, hey, we should put a moratorium in place. But I would just say, if you don't have a moratorium in place, or put a moratorium in place so you don't entice us to spend all this money and jump through all these hoops only to find out later that, you know, it's not appropriate.
Diet had applied for a special use permit beginning in April. The city's Planning and Zoning Commission then continued the meetings until May 26th, when it recommended denial of the application. Diet chose a unit of the small commercial strip at 2114 Grand Avenue, currently occupied by a barber shop and framing shop. He planned on remodeling the barber shop and opening it as a pot store. The P&Z said that Diet's proposal was not in compliance with the goal of the city's comprehensive plan to attract diverse businesses and promote businesses that are not in direct competition with the downtown core. There were also concerns about parking and access, as well as how close the store would be to existing businesses like the Cedar Lodge and residences behind the store. Council members reiterated those concerns. Paula Stepp said that she felt like this application was putting the cart before the horse.
The landlord needs to figure out access and parking. If this is the type of business he wants with the quantity of people that will be coming and going, then something needs to be done to take care of that situation.
There was discussion about how many pot shops are in town and whether that's too much. Stepp asked Trent Hyatt, city planner, about limits on marijuana shops in town.
There is not currently a limit. It has been tossed around as an idea, but staff has not received any direction from city council to address that matter. I think that you will hear from our Planning and Zoning Commission that it's something that they would like to discuss, but currently no maximum requirement.
Okay, and Carl had his hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to add on to that. Paula, the last time we redrafted the regulations surrounding that, we based it on distances between businesses, which had an effect of limiting the number of spots that are available when you count the distance from schools, the distance from each other, those kinds of factors. So there's a limited number of places, and at that time, council was comfortable with that approach.
Both Charlie Wellman and Rick Voorhees agreed that this decision was not about marijuana sales or use in town. Voorhees added that it's time the city determines if it wants to set a limit on pot stores.
I think it's a little bit unfair to an applicant to sort of make this a moving target. I'm sympathetic to the people who say that we have too many, but I think we have a fundamental obligation as a legislative body to make that determination and then to live by it. You know, we need to have that discussion perhaps citywide about what we're going to be willing to tolerate in the future.
Council member Steve Davis said the council is supposed to represent city residents.
We can't have a discussion here about how many pot shops or what's enough or what's not enough. The reality is that we represent the citizens of Glenwood Springs. I've had a lot of comment, both written and oral, regarding this. And everybody that I have had communication with feels like it's not compatible with the surrounding area and that it's not consistent with the general purpose and intent of the development code.
Councilman Tony Hershey called the motion to uphold the Planning and Zoning Commission's decision to deny the application. The motion passed 5-2. In an email to KDNK, Mayor Jonathan Godis, who disagreed with last night's decision, said the applicant can reapply if he comes up with a suitable location that complies with the city's code. The U.S. Senate today passed the Great American Outdoors Act on a 73-25 vote, reports the Center for Biological Diversity. The legislation fully and permanently funds the Land and Water Conservation Fund and provides money for aging infrastructure and maintenance needs in national parks. Colorado Senator Cory Gardner, a Republican, introduced the bill in March. According to Colorado Public Radio, critics say it's a political move to appeal to conservation voters heading into the November election. Senator Michael Bennett, a Democrat and co-sponsor of the Colorado Outdoor Recreation and Economy, or CORE Act, which would protect 400,000 acres of land in the state, including the Thompson Divide, applauded the passage of the Great American Outdoors Act. In a press release, Bennett said he has worked on fully funding the Land and Water Conservation Fund for over a decade. Bennett had also offered to amend the CORE Act to the Great American Outdoors Act, but to no avail. The Great American Outdoors Act now goes to the U.S. House. A combination of red flag weather and smoke filling the Roaring Fork and Colorado River valleys this week raised concerns about a local wildfire. David Boyd, public affairs officer for the White River National Forest, said that wasn't the case.
It's really interesting. It's every summer we'll have a few days like this where a bunch of smoke dumps in to the Colorado River Valley and on up, just the way conditions are working, but we don't have any fires close by. So the nearest fire to us is the East Canyon Fire down by Main Coast. That's about 2,700 acres. So some of the smoke's coming from that, but the majority is coming from Arizona, where they have about 10 large fires. The closest of those fires to us is the Magnum Fire, which is on the Kaibab Plateau, and that's at 30,000 acres and growing. So just a lot of smoke in the atmosphere, and just the way conditions are right now, this smoke is coming to us. What's interesting, though, is the fire season kind of starts down there in Arizona and New Mexico, and once they start getting more fires, you know, it's, fire season is getting much closer to us, where we have the potential for, you know, these larger fires. We always do, but as we get further along in the summer, the potential grows. So although we don't have any fires in our area right now, this is a good warning for people. They're just a good reminder for people to be careful with fire, because we are in fire season now.
Are there fire restrictions in place in the Tri-County area, meaning Pitkin, Eagle, Garfield County, Forest Service lands, BLM lands?
Right now, there are no fire restrictions in these areas on BLM or Forest Service lands, but that's something we look at every week with local officials, and we're monitoring the conditions, we're monitoring how dry things get, and it doesn't mean there's no fire danger. So people just need to always be really careful with the fires and make sure they're out before they leave camp, and watch things like parking in dry grass or using equipment that creates sparks and those sorts of things, because things are drying out and fire danger is increasing.
That was David Boyd, public affairs officer for the White River National Forest. And finally, COVID-19 is on the rise in Colorado and in local counties. According to the Colorado Department of Health, the Centers for Disease Control, and Aspen Journalism, as of Friday, June 19th, Colorado reported 30,187 confirmed cases, up more than 2,500 cases in 2 weeks. Garfield County reports 214 confirmed cases, an increase of 56 in 2 weeks. Pitkin County reports 80 confirmed cases, up from 59 cases on June 5th. Eagle County reported 603 cases 2 weeks ago and now has 639. And for months, Rio Blanco County held steady at one confirmed COVID-19 case. Now there are two. That does it for this week's newsreel on KDNK. All of our stories and more are at kdnk.org. The Weekly Newsreel is a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.